May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Sullivy, representing the appellant Donald Strike. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do so. Just watch the clock, counsel.
Your Honors, Donald Strike, as a juvenile, was convicted of a sexual offense. And as a juvenile, he agreed, pursuant to an immunity agreement from the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office, to engage in psychosexual counseling. He agreed to do that, actually, with two separate immunity agreements with the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office. And he went in, I assume, with the expectation, like anyone would assume, going in to seeing their doctor or going in to see their mental health
counsel. The word "there" is where I fell off the track. It's not really his doctor. It's government counseling because he's done some terrible things. And what's more, in sentencing, generally the court has access to everything. There are a whole lot of private areas that are generally private, but with exceptions. For example, any of us files a personal injury case, our confidential medical records have to be handed over to the defense lawyer unless we can show that portions of them are irrelevant. And I cannot imagine doing a responsible sentencing without getting access to this sort of record, and I can't see that it was his doctor, and I really can't see why immunity from prosecution has anything to do with disclosure to the sentencing judge.
It's very relevant, Your Honor, because it goes to whether or not a release, whether or not a waiver, is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Mr. Sullivan, what difference does that make in this case where the district court did not use or rely on any of the material and where prospect of being subject to the Adam Walsh Act is hypothetical and speculative?
In terms of the hypothetical nature, I think it's not at all hypothetical. I think if I could look at an analogy, it would be the closest analogy I can think of would be, let's say, in the Seattle School District, there was that teachers had the option to engage in private psychological counseling, mental health counseling. That was part of the agreement. You could go in and talk about anything. Part of the agreement was that there would be privacy no matter what you say.
Could you direct us to the page so we can follow along with what you're saying?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Could you direct us to the page in the excerpts that shows the precise terms of his entering into the counseling so we can follow along as you speak about it?
Or are you talking about something that happened in this case, really? Or are you talking about some hypothetical involving a school district?
Well, I'm coming to the hypothetical with regards to whether or not it's right, whether or not this...
Well, that kind of loses me. Can we stick to just what really happened here? I mean, you assert that you're going to be subject to the Adam Walsh Act. Well, first of all, the government has to proceed. They have to make a decision to proceed whenever he's sprung from his custody term. Then your client will have all sorts of procedural rights at that point, including a court hearing and everything else, to say you shouldn't use this stuff. And I guess I'd finally say, what difference does it make anyway, since you've already got these convictions for the same kind of conduct, and they're certainly going to get all this stuff anyway?
Your Honor, it makes a big difference, because, first of all, the regulations, the proposed regulations for the Bureau of Prisons is that pre-sentence reports must be reviewed. And in the world of sexual violent predators and commitment statutes, what's really the battle is whether or not the commitment petition will be filed in the first place. Once it's filed.
Sure, but they're going to know about, I mean, I guess I'm just having an awful lot of trouble understanding why this is the time to deal with that. If and when it happens, then you've got a chance to take a shot at it.
Because the bell has been rung. Once it's in the pre-sentence report, it's not like a regular criminal trial. It's a very low standard that anything goes in. As a matter of fact, I spoke with an attorney yesterday who does these types of cases, and they say it's a very low standard for what could go in. And as a matter of fact, defense counsel made a record. Defense counsel, in this case, does some of that type of work, and I think that's what alarmed him, because he saw what the reality is. The reality of these commitment proceedings is, once it's filed, it's virtually impossible to succeed in not being civilly committed for life. Okay. I think what's important is to look at the gravity, the extreme exposure faced by these individuals.
Well, we have a ripeness issue here. Isn't that the problem?
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that on the same point. We have a ripeness issue here. In other words, do we have jurisdiction to take into account these considerations with respect to a potential invocation of the Adam Walsh Act?
Well, there's two things. First of all, it's very simple. There's a Rule 32 violation. Rule 32 says nothing in the pre-sentence report should be in there that was provided upon a promise of confidentiality. And there's some wisdom to that. And that is a present violation of Rule 32.
Counsel, let's say we go with you on the ripeness. I still have an unanswered question. You've got two provisions in tension with each other. 18 U.S.C. 3661 says no limitation shall be placed on the information concerning the background, character, and conduct of a person convicted of an offense which the United States may receive and consider for the purpose of imposing an appropriate sentence. That struck me as the touchstone. Then you've got Rule 32, which says the pre-sentence report must exclude the following: any sources of information obtained upon a promise of confidentiality. Now, I would like to reconcile those in the least aggressive way possible, and it would help if I could read the promise of confidentiality. That's why I asked you the page in the excerpt, so that I could follow along. Show me the exact terms of what his promise of confidentiality was.
In terms of what the prosecutor's office?
You're saying that the information was confidential, so it falls under Rule 32 D3B. So I want to read what the promise of confidentiality is, the words.
From the
whoever it came from. I think you said it came from the
prosecutor. It's actually in the pre-sentence report.
Is that the only information I have on it?
That's the only information. I actually, Your Honor, I did some work to try to find out what those promises of confidentiality
A lot of promises are defeasible. They're subject to exceptions. One exception is, this is absolutely confidential unless I'm required to report it to a court. This is absolutely confidential unless it comes in some legal context where I'm required to disclose it. There are all kinds of confidential promises like that. Also, there are communications. This absolutely cannot be used against you to prosecute you for any other crimes. Well, it's not being used against him to prosecute him for any other crimes. So I want to see what the terms are.
And one thing you are asking, Your Honor, I'd like to see what the terms are.
Let's look at the words. Help me with this. Let's look at the words. Show me exactly what the words are in the pre-sentence report.
One thing I would like to point out, Your Honor, is that defense counsel asked for an evidentiary hearing
unless there's something.
And I don't have the specific words of what the confidentiality agreement were.
Look, if you want to prove that this is confidential, so it falls within the exception instead of the 3661 rule that says everything can be considered, you got to show me it's confidential. So show me. This is my third opportunity. I'm really begging for it. I want to see the words.
And I apologize, Your Honor. The only thing that I have to go on is the pre-sentence report. I contacted the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office. I tried to get those agreements. I made numerous phone calls to try to get that information. I couldn't. But what's important is defense counsel asked for an evidentiary hearing to get that information and to present it.
Speaking of words, why don't we just look at the words of Rule 32D3B, which refer to any sources of information obtained upon a promise of confidentiality. I don't see anything in there that says just because a promise of confidentiality has been made, the material is protected. What's protected is the source. So if you've got a confidential informant who is providing information that gets put into the PSR, the source is protected. Here that would simply be the source of the psychological information, not the information itself.
The text of the rule doesn't make those distinctions between informants and not.
No, but it says what it protects is any source of information. What's the source of information that's being protected here?
The source of information is the psychological, the notes made by the mental health care provider.
Well, that's not source, that's the substance. What's the source of information that you say is being protected or should be protected that wasn't?
Well, I think it's to protect persons, but also a person's personal information. And I believe that is what's being protected. And the other thing to consider is the district court judge, Judge Layton, stated to Mr. Strike, he did the plea, he said, you are required to provide full cooperation to the probation officer. He said it twice. And this is instructions from a federal judge who commands tremendous authority, saying you must cooperate fully. And the purpose of the interview is to get criminal background information. So,
Counsel, you're still talking at a more general level than is helpful to me. You must have just picked up that your Rule 32 exception may be limited to protecting the name of the source instead of the information. But I still would like to see the confidentiality agreement. You said it's in the pre-sentence report, and I'm not seeing the exact words.
Well, Counsel, you may want to reserve your remaining time, and during that time, prepare yourself to answer the question.
And the only reference is in the pre-sentence report, Your Honor, and I'll find that.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court. My name is Mark Parent. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I also handled this case in Judge Layton's court. Essentially, what we have here is a question of whether Judge Layton followed the proper procedure for determining whether information should be included in a pre-sentence report, and he did. Rule 32 governs that procedure, and Rule 32 permits inclusion in a pre-sentence report of information both that would be helpful at sentencing and for other purposes such as treatment. Judge Layton made the determination that when this information about the earlier offenses by the defendant when the defendant was a juvenile was not something that he would use for purposes of sentencing. Therefore, he wasn't even required under the rule to make a determination about the accuracy or to rule on the challenge by defense counsel.
Counsel, I was thinking if we never get to civil commitment, even if no civil commitment proceeding is ever brought, the pre-sentence report might be used by the Bureau of Prisons for placement. They choose what institution to put somebody in and what programs to require the person to submit to or offer to the person based on information in the pre-sentence report. What I'm wondering is whether this information would be useful for that. I would have thought it would be because the guy seems like a very serious sex offender, and it's amplified by the information. And I would think they'd maybe send him to Butner or maybe put him in some intensive sex offender program or something.
I think they might, and that's an appropriate use of the information, because Rule 32 contemplates that the information can also be used for correctional treatment. And, of course, the goal here is to provide him the treatment while he's in custody. So, I mean, I think everyone hopes a civil commitment proceeding will never be necessary.
Okay, let's say that we're not talking about civil commitment. We're talking about use of the information in the pre-sentence report. It was not used for sentencing. The judge didn't consider it. I would imagine he might have doubled the sentence if he knew the history. But it'll be, let's say it's ripe because it's used for placement, hypothetically. Now, why wouldn't he get a hearing on it?
Because, first, the rule does not provide a hearing if the judge is not going to use the material for sentencing. And this court, in the Saturn case that I cited in the brief, dealt with a very similar question and ruled that things such as prison placement, there are other forums for the defendant to challenge actions of other people who rely on information in the pre-sentence report. And also another use of the information that's appropriate was testified to by the probation officer in the evidentiary hearing. He said that this is the kind of information that the supervising probation officer, who will be supervising the defendant when he's released after serving his sentence, would rely on, and also would be necessary to fashion an appropriate treatment program. And that makes sense, because what we have absent that information is very bad. There's no question. But what the additional illumination that that challenged information provides is that the defendant has been doing this since a very young age. And I think that that's the kind of information that in devising a treatment plan would be very helpful to a treatment provider. And I think that's why Judge Layton left it in the pre-sentence report. But because of the issues raised by defense counsel, he did not want to use it for purposes of sentencing and perhaps call the sentencing into question. He, as he said, he felt he had more than enough information to apply a proper sentence.
Is your position that this information is not technically confidential within the meaning of Rule 32?
No, it's not, because as Judge Reimer pointed out, Rule 32 protects the source of the information. And when you read that plain language along with the commentary that I think illuminates it, that the clear intent was to protect sources who may be providing information, and the revealing the source could provide all the dangers that we're familiar with. And so to take that rule and somehow say that that protects something that the defendant may have provided upon some promise of confidentiality just distorts the rule beyond its intention and beyond its clear language.
All right. Anything further, counsel?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Solovey, you have some reserved time.
Yes, Your Honor. And the question was, is what information do I have about the immunity agreements? And they're on excerpt of record, page 25, paragraph 65. It says officers contacted the county prosecutor's office and learned that Strike had been given immunity for any information he disclosed about unadjudicated crimes during his participation in sexual deviancy treatment. On paragraph 70, ER 26, it says officers contacted the county prosecutor's office and verified that Strike had been given immunity for any information he disclosed about unadjudicated crimes.
I don't see the conflict. Immunity just means he won't be prosecuted for the additional crimes he discloses, and he wasn't and hasn't been.
What is important is I believe that the language in Rule 32 is broad enough. It says nothing made upon a promise of confidentiality. To me,
I don't see a confidentiality promise, just an immunity promise.
They
can call somebody in front of Congress and make them testify under a grant of immunity, and it can be on television in front of the whole world. He's got immunity but not confidentiality.
This is with either a psychiatrist, a doctor. I think when anyone goes in to see a mental health care counselor, if I go in to see my doctor, I'm going to assume that my doctor is going to it's going to maintain confidentiality. What we are looking at is not what's in our minds and parsing out the words, but if it's a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver, it's in what's Mr. Strike's mind. What would he could reasonably assume? He could reasonably assume that there were immunity agreements. The context was, if you plead guilty, if you engage in counseling, we promise we're not going to use this against you. So in terms of, it's not whether immunity agreement could bind a federal court or could bind the government. It's all about whether or not it's a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. And Mr. Strike, being a juvenile at the time, going to a doctor, had more than reasonable cause to believe that what he said would be privileged. And I think there is a hallowed cloak of doctor-patient privilege. And I believe, Your Honor, that must be deeply respected. Thank you very much.
Counsel. The case just argued will be submitted for decision. Before we hear the next case, the court is aware that there's standing room only in the court. I wonder if law clerks to any of the judges would be willing to give up their seats and take seats inside the bar here. I notice there are two chairs over there. There's a third one over there. I don't know if there's another one over there, but that may go a long way toward freeing up some space so that we don't have to have standees. Thank you very much. The next case for oral argument is Loya versus Starwood Hotels. Counsel?